Hello and welcome back to the Music Creative Podcast with me, Hugh, or 93 Acres. And once again, for the second episode in a row, we have the wonderful Dr. Richard Molloy. Richard, how are you things?
Not too bad. I didn't know it was in a row, actually, so...
Yeah, we're
on a roll.
Well, I'm not on a roll because I haven't actually posted since our last chat, which is a shame.
You've dropped the ball.
Yeah, I'll blame Paddy's Day. We're recording the day after St. Patrick's Day here in Dublin, Ireland. So,
sore heads on one of us anyway.
Just deeper voices. That's the only real change. But we're raring to go. I have my water here beside me, so we'll be hydrated and good to go. So today's podcast is going to be all about drum production. So we're going to be talking about your preference between recording MIDI samples or audio samples, how to choose those samples, are there any drum machines we can use, and we can find our samples in different places. We'll look at that. Any drum patterns and maybe certain genres and how certain drum patterns, learning off certain drum patterns in certain genres can really help you in certain ways. We'll look at that as well, and everything in between. And we might brush on mixing at the end if we have enough time. And of course, Richard, if people that haven't listened to the last podcast, you are a doctorate of music, not a medical doctor.
True.
And you are a drummer.
Yeah. Play bass and drums are my kind of main instruments. So I'd say a lot of the things that I do are focused on that, like first and foremost.
Yeah. So it's easy to say, or safe to say, that you have a good handle on rhythm.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I'm interested in it. Yeah.
It's always safe. Yeah. I'm interested in it. I have a passion in rhythm, the rhythmic side of things.
I won't toot any horns. Yeah.
And then there's me just playing all the nice high frequencies that you can play all the wrong notes and get away with it all the time, which is handy.
Easy.
Let's jump straight into it. Audio versus MIDI. What do you use, Richard, for recording your drums when it's not real drums you're recording? What would you go? What's your preference? And what would you be aware of when you're using audio or MIDI?
I think for me that the hardest part of doing anything drum wise is actually just getting started with drum sounds. So whatever your workflow is, I would suggest, and this has worked for me, that you just find a small few samples that have different sounds that you enjoy and that you think work well together, and just have them stored somewhere. So I know for me, up in Ableton, up on the left-hand side, I have this kind of little tab where I just have a few different drum kits or collections of drum samples that I use regularly. So if I'm going for kind of a lo-fi thing, I'll just jump into one of the kits I have made there. If I'm doing something techno, I'll probably grab a 909. That's kind of my approach there. It can be a tough thing sometimes. I mean, one of the things I probably enjoy least about producing music is actually scrolling through samples. So, you know, we've all been in the situation where we're trying to make a beat and the kick drum is not sitting quite right, and then next thing you know, we're scrolling through these different pages and upon pages of like doom, 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 like just for half an hour, and then by the time you get it, you've kind of lost you've kind of lost that idea that you were working on, or even just the kind of motivation to keep going. So definitely have some ready to go, kind of come back to them later once the idea is already fleshed out. I'd say then really start worrying about like what is the actual drum sound. Or the other approach you could take, which I've had some success in the past with, is either using a plugin that's dedicated to making drum sounds. So I can think of some that are good for kick drums. Like I've used one called Punchbox a few times just for getting the kick drum dialed in at the start. Or you could use some outboard gear as well. So I know in my own studio here, I have a Vermona drum machine. So it's got individual channels for each of the different drum voices. So there's one for kick, and it just gives me a little bit more control over the start. So I'm not working with a sample, I'm working with more of a synthesizer, and I can dial in the attack, release, all the different characteristics of the bass drum that I want at the start. And I find that a bit more hands-on, which is always good, and a bit quicker than scrolling and something is not quite right and then you have to mix it anyway. So that's something that's worked for me as well.
Yeah, that's a great point about scrolling through the samples and like just slightly different variations of sounds, and you can get lost there and you might lose yourself in the moment. Would you spend days getting drum kits together, like, oh, today's this Saturday morning, I'm going to sit down, or have you done this in the past? Sit down and just say, okay, I'm going to get my lo-fi kick samples all in one place, or a drum machine all ready to go. Would you sit down and spend some time doing that on its own?
Yeah, I think in a perfect world, I'd do it just like you said there, where I'd have the idea ahead of time and I'd say, this is my day for doing it. But usually, yeah, I've done it a few different times where I've just said, I've gone and thought to myself, this is ridiculous now. I have way too many of these. I need to clear out the stuff I don't use and sort everything. I do that every so often as well. Even recently with my plugins, I was starting to just organizing my plugins inside my DAW. There's a kind of way of color coding them in Ableton that I use to sort them all by different categories. And I've changed that recently because I found that one of the menus for instruments, for example, was way too big. And I was like, you know, I'd be looking for a particular instrument for this thing, and I'd spend ages just staring at the plugin menu trying to find it. Because, you know yourself, some of them have pretty funky names. I know, I think it's, I might get this wrong, but I think it's D16 is the plugin company that make the 303 emulation that I like for bass lines, and it's called something crazy like Faux Scion or something like that. And they have another one called whatever else, like these, all these crazy names that make no sense to me, and I'm just kind of looking through them. So it's the same with drum samples as well, to just have kits made and that you can just drag in and say, okay, yeah, this is good for hip hop. And as far as I know as well, you'll have a certain thing that you like in kick drums. Or any kind of drum sound as well. I'm pretty picky in that sort of thing. So because of that, maybe there's only a few that I actually quite like. And then within a track, I'll actually just EQ it to make it sound different, as opposed to spending half an hour finding a new sample, because you don't know what the samples are like beforehand. Usually they're not organized well if you get them off a website. It's something to actually do. It's not fun, but it will make a big difference if you just have, to your kind of productivity, if you have kits ready to go.
Yeah, and let's actually just delve into that for a second, just for anyone who might not be very used to making drum kits. So first, how would you define a sample? So we were talking about samples. How would you define a sample?
I guess in this context, a sample is just a short little piece of audio that represents a drum sound. So there's two ways of getting electronic style drums in a DAW. The first would be using samples. So it's an actual audio recording of a snare drum. And you can kind of trigger it by pressing MIDI or whatever way you want to do it. Or you can lay it out on the grid and copy and paste the timeline, I should say. Or the other way is, like I said, using a kind of dedicated plugin that is really good at making snare sounds, making whatever, drum sounds. Those are the two different ways of doing it. So a sample is just a short piece of audio. So in kind of drum production, one common way of referring to this type of sample is a one shot, because it's something you're just going to play just once as well. There's a lot you can do with that. You can get in, say, a kick drum sample that you like, and then say, well, it's not really quite high enough. If you're using a kind of some sort of sample playback thing, so there's one of those in every DAW, well, most of the good modern DAWs, I would say, definitely Logic, definitely Ableton, you can kind of have that sample as your starting point, pitch it up or down if you need to be lower or higher. You can probably play with the envelope, so you can adjust, you know, how does it attack? Does it have a very quick transient or that sort of thing? Or does it take is it a bit of a softer thing? EQ makes a huge difference, like I said before. So there's really a lot involved with just the very start of a track, which is, you know, getting a kick drum, whether that's a four on the floor pattern. There still is a degree of a decision there of, well, what does that actual kick sound like?
Yeah. Okay. So we have our sample, and we're talking about drum kits. So how would you, you work in Ableton mostly. If you're a new user to Ableton, where do you go to, you know, where is your drum kit? Where do you bring these samples in? Where do you drag them into?
I guess if you're new to Ableton, up at the very top left, it's hard to imagine the exact menus now. I think there's just a tab called Drums. You go into that and there's a bunch of pre-made selections of samples that are put together. So just different drum kits. So anybody who's interested in making some techno, you'll probably be using one or two samples, if not the whole range of samples from the 909 drum machine, which was a very popular thing Roland came out with. And you can kick, you can use Ableton's built-in kind of 909 clone inside the DAW, drag it onto a track, and then use your keyboard or whatever, or MIDI notes to play back these different sounds.
Yeah. And in Logic, yeah, something very similar. We can use, you know, there's a few different ones, like Ultra Beat is the old style. Not the prettiest drum machine, but it does work. You can drag in your samples, and you can also use like the Quick Sampler now, which is a little bit nicer, or the normal sampler.
Yeah, in Ableton, if you want to use your own samples, usually you would use either the sampler or simpler if you're just using one sound. And if you want to do multiple different sounds, like a full drum kit, there's a something called the drum rack. Yeah, and there's a way of switching between those two as well. There's loads you can do.
Do you have any favorite drum machines that you've bought yourself that don't come with Ableton or Logic?
I have a few emulations of older drum machines, so any of the Roland stuff. So they all have kind of numbered names, like 808 is the one you use in hip hop a lot of the time. 909 is for a lot of the techno music, but there's other older ones as well, 606. So I have a few kind of emulation plugins of that. Like I mentioned before, I have a hardware unit in this room here that I use for drums. That's by a company called Vermona. What else? Another thing I do as well sometimes is I sample from actual drum beats. So if I really like the kick drum from a particular song, I'll just download a beat or a break, which is kind of a old-fashioned way of doing things, kind of a 90s approach to things. I'll download the beat and I'll cut it up in my sampler. So maybe the snare hits on beat two, so I'll zoom in on that, kind of cut it up, and use MIDI to trigger that sound anytime I want it.
And do you ever drag in, do you ever save lots of sounds that you've picked up over the years, save them in like a folder, and then when you're making a beat, drag it in as audio, or do you drag them in and then input it as MIDI more often than not?
Yeah, absolutely. A bit of both. I think a lot of the time...
What's the positives and negatives of either of those? Are there...
Well, I suppose if you drag in the full beat into your production... Well, then you're kind of stuck with that. And usually I'll be kind of particular about that thing. You know, I play drums. I'm into kind of drum production and a few different more advanced techniques of making beats. So I'm definitely picky about that. It'd be rare that I would find an exact drum beat that I just want to kind of copy and paste into my project. So like one way of thinking about it is you can drag in a full sample and only use, say, for example, the higher end of that. So the kind of cymbals, the shakers, that sort of thing. You can use a filter to cut out the low end and add your own kick drum in, add your own snare, that sort of thing, and just use the high end, like, you know, hi-hats, shakers, that sort of thing. And you can get loops that are like that. And I've had success. I know you do that in your own production as well. I've had some success with that sort of thing where you might call them shaker loops or that sort of thing where you would, yeah, just get in some of the kind of spicier extra parts. But as far as laying down kicks and snares, I usually want to do that rhythm myself. And chopping up an existing beat gives you kind of an interesting effect as well, because sometimes if you're listening to an actual drummer, or most of the time really, they're not just hitting a bass drum in isolation. They're hitting a bass drum at the same time as the hi-hat. So if you sample that exact beat, unless you go out of your way to filter the hi-hat out, sometimes you get a cool effect by actually when you play back that sample, the hi-hat comes with it. You get both at the same time, and that can be an interesting effect.
Yeah, and I just like you said there, loops can be really fun to work with. If you bring in a full loop, and then even chopping it up gives you just lots of the cool little artifacts, nearly mistakes that are like mistakes that shouldn't be there, but they kind of sound cool, adds atmosphere. And also, yeah, you're mixing in maybe those very processed, very clean recordings of a one-shot, as you call them, one-shot samples, and then mixing that in with something that's a little bit more real, has a bit more roomy, well, maybe not necessarily roomy, but like more, I don't know, dynamic to it. And it can really work well together. Like if you have, an 808 hi-hat that's just closed hi-hat going, but then you have your own recorded, you have your own hi-hat, bring it in, record that, and layer them on top of each other. Could be sound, sure. Really cool.
Yeah, and even you should think about When you're programming drums, so you're actually just typing in the kicks, snares and hi-hats that you want, you should be thinking a little bit dynamically like that so that it doesn't sound too static. It depends on the context as well. I mean, if you're doing some really dark techno stuff, maybe it's supposed to be that way. But for lots of different genres of music, having that bit of dynamic or bit of change is really important. So one thing I might do is just to get a bit of movement going in each of the different parts. So that could be a few things you could look at. Say for your hi-hat samples, if it's a synth, or if you're using a sample and you apply an envelope to that sample, you know, like you can mess with the attack and decay, just moving the decay back and forth as the beat plays is a really good idea to get a bit of life going, because, you know, these are the sort of things that you would get with a real drummer playing as well. And even if you're not trying to sound like real drums, that sort of effect is something that is really musical, so it's good to incorporate.
Ah, that's really cool. I love that. That's a really good use of something like that, where you're taking, you know, a process sample and editing it with automation to make it sound more real. That's the kind of stuff I really struggled with at the beginning, just to make the drums feel a bit more alive, as opposed to just, you know, I suppose that you might typically hear with a beginner producer, everything feels very static. There's not much life. Although of course, there's occasions where you want something that's pretty static. But that's something I've noticed as well with a lot of producers, like people that I've researched, like say your Charlie Puth, your Phineas, Pharrell Williams, Chad Hugo, and Justin Timberlake as well. They love recording in real sounds. Like even it's just them beatboxing, in particular with Justin Timberlake and Charlie Puth. They love just beatboxing whatever the drum is and just put it in at a low level underneath, just to give it some sort of, yeah, just an extra bit of dynamicism. Dynamism.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of the great beat makers or producers, they add some sort of element like that to whatever they're doing. So the example that always sticks out for me when I think about making drums would be Jay Dilla. So looking up the way that he would do it, he would use an MPC. So he would be kind of typing in his drums just like you'd play on a keyboard. But his timing being imprecise, and adding a bit of groove, that's very much part of his production. And, you know, people can spend years trying to figure out how that works. So you can look at it as something that you can, like, there's definitely techniques to emulate that sort of sound, like make sure that, like, anything that's supposed to be on the main beats is a little bit early and the stuff that's off beat is a little bit late, and that gives a kind of a feel. There's also ways of programming in a groove. So on like an MPC machine and in Ableton as well, and loads of DAWs, you can change the amount of groove. So how evenly spaced stuff is, how much it lines with the grid. You can use a number to do that, or just you can practice and get good at playing in beats in a way that you like the kind of variation. So maybe you don't press the kick drum button as loud, exactly the same amount as loud every time, you know. That's a natural thing as well. And keeping that intact in your productions is could be a really big thing, and it will make a big difference in the end.
I'm so glad you mentioned Jay Dilla, because if anyone's listened to this and hasn't listened to Jay Dilla yet, you really do have to listen to Jay Dilla. He's influenced like everything pretty much, and anyone who's influenced by anything that isn't Jay Dilla has been influenced by Jay Dilla. So it's still,
for sure.
You know, like he just totally, you know, influenced, so like, oh, just crazy. The beats are just so alive, if that makes sense. So yeah, I'd suggest maybe not pause the podcast, wait till the end of the podcast and go first thing, drop your phone, go and listen to Jay Dilla. Just, oh, it's just amazing. So, so good. And would you say recording things in would be a good option, even if you have like drum pads, or even assigning the drum kit, you know, to the, if you have a MIDI keyboard, MIDI controller, and assigning it to, you know, the notes on the keyboard and playing it in?
I mean, that's usually how I start, actually. I mean, yeah, usually I'll do things part by part. I have kind of a habit of programming hi-hats a lot by typing that in, like, you know, with a mouse, or, you know, you get good at drawing certain patterns and learning what works and what doesn't. But usually if it's kind of kick and snare, I would probably, yeah, type it in on a keyboard. And if it needs to be quantized after, because that's the style, I'll do that. But usually it's just quicker than, yeah, doing another way. Like, yeah, especially if I'm doing like something that doesn't, that's more than like a bar or two long, Which, by the way, I highly recommend. I mean, generally, if you're looking at a drummer in a band, or just, yeah, most people who are passionate about making like drum beats, they don't tend to be just one bar long. Like, usually there's a longer story to it, in that it kind of takes place over 4 bars, 8 bars. And some of the nicest bits of production that I can think of usually have something that happens maybe once every 16 bars, just that little bit of change, or there's constantly a tiny bit of change, like, you know, like we talked earlier about the decay opening and closing or whatever. These sort of things like add up, and the more things like that you practice and start putting in one at a time into your productions, the more accustomed you get to that process, and then you can come up with some really cool stuff.
Absolutely, really believe in that. And that's actually something that came up repeatedly in my podcast chat with Zach, where we talked about arrangement. And it's the same with arranging things, just even a little, like, even if it's one arpeggio, just like in a really reverb sounding keys, and it just happens once, it's just keeping it fresh, something new happening, arranging sounds so that, like, just it, to avoid the total like loop culture, which obviously has its place as well. But if you're working straight in the box in your laptop the whole time, you can run the risk, and I have done many, many times, of just it becoming very stagnant, and you want it to feel alive, and just something that happens once off, like even your hi-hat opens for one or two hits and then goes back on like a different beat every couple of bars or something. It can just, yeah, give it that extra bit of life that you want.
Yeah, just now that I think of it, one of the producers that I think is amazing as well is Toro y Moi, if you've ever listened to him. One of my favorite albums of all time is Anything in Return by him. There's this one song, Rose Quartz, that I really like by that artist, and the drum production in that is particularly good. I think he does an amazing job of blending a lot of the stuff from electronic music, so he'll use a lot of stuff from drum machines basically, but also acoustic drum samples, also that bit of kind of like beatboxing or scatting or whatever you want to call it. He'll add all of that in together, and just the sort of sound whirls and just the little details that are in that production, I think that it's amazing. And I think overall, if you want to learn about how to make good beats, you have to listen to good ones and listen to different styles as well, because a lot of what goes on in like a drum loop or that sort of thing, most of it will have a cultural connection or a kind of a history. Like if you do a certain rhythm, it'll give a certain vibe. So it might sound very, you know, 90s trance, or it might have kind of a rock feel. There's all these different drum beats that we associate it with certain styles. And if you want to make something that's either completely different, you'll need to avoid certain things. Like if you do something that's been done a lot, then your music is probably not going to sound as different as it could. But similarly, if you want to make stuff that's really polished or kind of pop focused, you have to know what sort of things are people doing, and you know, what do you have available to you as well. So I think a big part of learning how to make a good beat is just listening to lots of music. And I'm always of the opinion as well that whatever you can do is a few levels below what you've heard, at least with me anyway. Like, I think I know a good bit about different rhythms, about playing drums, this or that, and the stuff that I put together, you know, it's based on all these things that I know. And, you know, I'll never make the perfect one, but like the more I know, the more likely I am to make something good. That's the way I look at it anyway.
Yeah, sounds good. And for people out there that are wanting to find new samples, are there any places you go regularly to find new one-shots or loops?
That'd be a tough one for me. I never seem to run out of them. I'll just pick them up every now and again. I know within Ableton there's a little function for just downloading new packs. Like there's a kind of browser for that, and you can just get new stuff. And I never run out of stuff that way. And I do a lot of the synth side of programming as well, so I'm never short of like tiny variations that way as well. I think I have enough, you know. I'd more focus on what I have now. If I have kind of an understated beat, I'll use this kick drum, and I might just EQ it a little bit different if the track calls for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Need to find that balance between searching for new samples all the time and then just actually writing some music.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a secondary thing. I mean, I don't think it's that inspiring. I definitely think sometimes a new synth sound can be really inspiring, but for me anyway, the joy of making a new beat is actually programming it, or like, you know, typing it in or whatever it is, and playing it or hearing it somewhere and going, I'd like to do something like that. I mean, most producers as well, as far as I know, they'll have a few samples that they use and they're kind of a signature. So that might be something to think about as well, like getting a sample and then crafting it and bringing it to a new place, and that'll be your snare drum. That's your hi-hat that you always use, or something like that. That's probably a healthier way to think about it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, like recording your own sounds, like you hitting a table and trying to make that into a snare, or maybe, and then layering it with other sounds you've recorded. And then, yeah, that's pretty cool. Then you have your snare, unique, no one else has it, give you a bit of something to stand out. Although if people want to find really good drums instantly, it's not a promoted piece here, but I found Splice very good. And there's a few free drum packs from Cymatics as well that I thought were quite good. And I've used a few of those a few times. Also, a producer called The Count. The Count, but Count spelled with a K. He's unbelievable. He's some really great drum packs that he's recorded himself, which are cool. I think he puts up a few of them for free online as well on his website. Yeah. But I definitely reiterate what you're saying. Like, if you can you make your own samples, that already gives you an edge up. And also, you're learning how to sound design at the same time. So it, like, you might spend a Saturday morning just creating a snare, but it will be worth it in the long run because you're improving your technical abilities and you're also ending up with sounds that are yours and uniquely yours.
Yeah, that's another thing as well. I watch a lot of the stuff that I think it was. Yeah, one of the producers I follow, maybe it was Janis Rasmussen from Chiasmos. I think it was him that I saw just doing. Definitely, I've seen someone do like just a day of batch snare making, because it is a similar process, no matter if you're making loads of different contrasting sounding ones. But yeah, like just literally having a session open and doing whatever processing you like times 10 with different samples and starting plays and adding stuff together and, you know, all that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, if you're browsing through samples and you're not finding what you want, it's because you have an idea about what a snare should sound like probably, or whatever it is. So why not try and make it? Why not figure out how those are made?
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me of a really funny time. I went for a weekend with Ben Connolly from All the Luck in the World, who I had on the podcast a couple of months ago, and with my sensei, my guru of producing, Stephen Lovett. And we went off to Wexford, to southeast of Ireland, for a weekend. Or was it a week? I'm not sure. Anyway, recording music. And our first song we wrote together, we wanted to make it about just the adventure of us going down there. And we were beside the beach, so we got stones from the beach and used the stones, hit the stones off different things in different ways to make a drum kit. So every single drum in that song, we never released it, we will eventually, every single drum sample in that song is from the stones from the beach that we were right beside. And I just thought that was so fun, you know?
Yeah, I like a lot of stuff like that. I know, I don't know, are they built in, but one of the drum kits that I have favored is called like toy drum kit or that sort of thing. And those sorts of sounds I think are really cool. And maybe if you made the whole track out of it, it might sound a bit, you know, it mightn't sound the best, but those as little extra elements can be really cool as well. It just left my head there.
That's right. I was going to ask you, how do you hitting a table into a snare? How do you drum design, like sound design, something like that?
Specifically that? I don't know. I mean,
or just like, what are your general go-tos? What are we trying to do? What are we working with? Like mixing wise or like plugin wise to help?
Yeah. So there, it's kind of different for the different instruments. I think for kick drums, usually you're working with a basic waveform, especially for pop, hip hop, that sort of thing. It's a basic waveform, like a sine wave or a square or something. And you're working with the envelope on that. And it'll be a bit faster than usually what you would have for kind of a synth sound or that sort of thing. So, and getting a really plucky envelope and having that as a kick. Oftentimes with kicks as well, it's gelling a few different sounds together. So in electronic music, one of the things that they talk about is just the kind of three elements of a kit, or kick, I should say, just being kind of the real low end, so the kind of thud or boom, then that kind of mid-range, what would be on a normal kit, the kind of sound of kind of hitting the skin, so that could be the thud, and then there'd be a kind of a click up at the higher end as well, and kind of blending those elements together, so you could make them individually, get everything lined up, and kind of put them all through the one compressor or something like that, and get them to glue together. That's something that people get really good at. There's loads of tutorials and that sort of thing online. I know Julian Earle, if anyone's into the kind of electronic production, he does a lot of kind of tutorials on synth sounds and how to make your own drum sounds and that sort of thing. So there's a lot that goes into that. With snares and hi-hats, it's usually actually working with noise as your starting point and kind of filtering that and using envelopes again to make these sorts of, just noisier sounds. There's some algorithms as well for generating metallic sounds, especially with hi-hats, that's really popular. Snares are usually noise, though, basically. It came back to me there. One producer who I think does really interesting, has a really interesting kind of like approach to percussion is Panther du Prince. I saw him live, it must be a while ago now because of COVID, but I think just before that kind of kicked off. And a lot of his production, he'll have a very standard boomy low kick drum, but a lot of the higher end of the percussion will be recorded in jingly bells and all that sort of stuff that he will sample himself. So a lot of people have a signature that way. Just thinking back to Chiasmos as well, one thing I really like about their production is the fact that the kick drum isn't really in your face, so it definitely sounds like it's kind of a low pass filter. It's something I do a lot on drums as well. I definitely find with a lot of the samples you download, they're all kind of like trying to be the loudest kick drum in the world and like hit you square in the face, and you know, the moment you drop them into your production, everything is loud. And that's one way of thinking about it. But if you're not making electronic dance music, if you're not making techno, that's oftentimes a bad thing, that the kick drum is the loudest thing in the world and it takes up all this space and that sort of thing. So I often find myself with things that are sent to me for mixes, for example, just low passing, just to make sure that, you know, there's room for other stuff to happen as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, for sure. Let's jump on to some patterns and what patterns you could use for certain genres. Are there any specific patterns you find commonly used or worth knowing as like even good starting points, and then you can, you know, move around the MIDI or the audio samples from there?
Yeah, I mean, there's the real basics of just kick on 1 and 3, or maybe 1, 2, 3, 4. If you're talking about a bar of 4/4, and then snares on the backbeat, which is beats 2 and 4. So if you have that in your grid, that's a lot of music right there. A lot of popular music is just some combination of that. And then it's about filling in the spaces in between. I'm definitely of a kind of a less is more kind of thing. I definitely find that producers who either I'm kind of teaching or just starting out, one thing they try and do is just fill up a lot of space drum wise. And a lot of the time the drums are kind of an accompanying part of the track overall. So less is more, but definitely there's different kind of off beats and that sort of thing that you can place kicks and snares in that can sound really cool. And sometimes just avoiding the kind of standard placement of everything can be really quite nice. Then, like, I think no matter what you're doing, I think it's the same as, you know, in many ways it's the same as good melody writing, where, you know, I'm sure you've done this with any of the production classes you've done on YouTube, where it's talking about like a melody being a story. So, you know, you have your A, then a variation on that, then a B phrase, maybe back to A again, or it could be a C. You know, there's different melodic structures. Like the same thing happens in drums a lot of the time, where if you look at a pattern across 8 bars, it might have a story to it, just like the one I mentioned there. and all these different ways of thinking. Generally for pop, rap, a lot of the more popular styles now, there's a kind of a conversation between the kick and the snare that we need to think about. And then above that, there sits the hi-hat, and that can either be really sparse or really busy. I definitely look at different patterns as well. One thing that I've got kind of newer producers to look at a lot is actually the hi-hat as an instrument, and using that as something like, if you have a very simple kick and snare pattern, just 2 and 4 sort of thing on the snare, 1 and 3 on the kick, maybe then the hi-hat takes a bit more, has a bit more interest to it. So even something like as simple as, if you don't know what to do, just maybe setting up a 16th note grid, typing in every single 16th note as a hi-hat, and then coming up, deleting every fourth one, deleting every third one. What does that sound like? Deleting a random set of them. Yeah, that's something you can do to kind of explore as well. Yeah, there's loads of ways of kind of getting creative with it like that. And just what we were talking about earlier as well, the dynamics. Generally, you want there to be some sort of flow to that as well. And even if your kick needs to be kind of right in the middle, in the face of the listener, like the loudest thing that's happening, well, then maybe it's time to think about making the hi-hats more dynamic. Because ultimately, I think there needs to be something like that in the mix for it to sound interesting. Otherwise, it'll just have that kind of, yeah, kind of amateur hour sort of vibe over the whole thing, where it's like, yeah, it's just really static, like you were saying earlier, repetitive, and it will sound repetitive, even though a lot of rhythms are repetitive. Just that little change in, you know, either the sound of the instrument or the velocity, the loudness of it, that will make it kind of tell more of a story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the suggestion of like having a beat and then dropping out sounds here and there to see how it sounds. And what I hear a lot is like your hi-hat, when you're playing a hi-hat, even if you're like an eighth beat, dropping out the hi-hat whenever the snare hits or something like that, that a drummer might do. Yeah. And like little things just to make it feel a bit more alive. Are there any other traits like that that you would put in as a real drummer when you're playing that us non-drummers would miss out on?
Yeah, if you're going for the effect of a real drummer, just sticking with the hi-hat for a minute, generally, especially if the hi-hat is playing reasonably quick, they're not evenly played. It's kind of uncomfortable to just kind of play like that, or once again, a bit amateur sounding, like a lot of beginner drummers like might play it like that. But after you're playing for a little bit, you develop this kind of accent pattern where it might be one note is strong and the next one is kind of weak, and you're kind of moving your arm around and that sort of thing. So just even being a bit mathematical about it at the start, where like, okay, every second hi-hat note is going to be quieter, just trying that out, see what that feels like, and then doing groups of three or something like that and seeing what that sort of sounds like. Yeah, like you were saying there, you know, cutting, like during a song, what happens when you take the snare out, what happens when the kick drum stops playing? That's something definitely to think about. But I was kind of thinking, like, if you have a pattern of 16th notes set up, or semi-quavers for those who go that way, just constant 16th notes, if you delete every third or fourth one, you can create some interesting patterns as well, which is another way of thinking about it as well, just to get a bit of variety into what you do. That's another approach you can think about as well. Yeah, just even if you have a beat open, if you've got your kick drum pattern, say you've got one bar of kick drum, duplicating that out and you have two bars, try and make a variation. Try and make sure that the next bar of kick drums does something a little bit different. Then take that two bar chunk, duplicate that out so you've got four bars, and maybe the last bar there you have a variation. So that there needs to be for sure a level of repetition for the listener to grab onto it. If it's different every single bar for 8 bars, that'll kind of overload the listener a little bit, and they won't be able to grab onto a groove. It mightn't be repetitive enough. But at the same time, there should be little changes as you go along. So that's one way of thinking about it. So writing one bar, duplicating it, change the second bar, then you have 2 bars. So you can change the kick each time, you can change, add something extra in on the snare drum, add something extra in on the hi-hat, maybe just change it up each time, but then that those two bars, duplicate that out, four bars, do a little change in the second half, eight bars. And, you know, then if you reach the whole kind of length of your verse, you'll have kind of an evolving rhythm, you know? That's another way to think about it as well. Like, you've got your verse here, so say it's 32 bars. What story is the drums going to tell along with your instrumentation during that? Like, are you going to add in pieces as you go? So maybe just at the very start of a verse, it's just kick and snare. Then the hi-hat comes in after four bars. Then after eight bars, there's the shaker that wasn't there before. And then right before the chorus, we cut some stuff back. You know, that totally comes down to you, what the song calls for, what's your own choice. But it's a way to think about it, of this kind of idea of like storytelling, even with just rhythm instruments that don't have a melody necessarily. This idea of something small changing every few bars. I think that's something to work on. For all of us, really, making sure that we don't just come up with that one bar beat and copy paste it, you know?
Yeah, sounds great. And then are there any typical changes you would usually go for when it comes to a chorus, like the difference between drums in the verse to drums in the chorus? Are you adding more crashes in? What would you say, double up on the hi-hats or more kick drums? Or are there any things you usually go to in the chorus to change it up from the verse?
Yeah, it depends on the style of music. If we're thinking verse chorus style, I definitely want the chorus to just support whatever's going on. So really, maybe everything needs to line up with what is being kind of played. Like, say for example, you can line the bass drum up with the bass guitar or whatever way your production works. I actually think sometimes the chorus should be a little simpler. Depends on the song. I mean, it's hard to say in a kind of vacuum, but you know, if it's a really sparse arrangement, maybe during the verse you can just have little changes in how things are played. But I think chorus needs to be the way it is. You need to come up with like the definitive drum beat for the chorus. And it needs to emphasize whatever is the hook. So if the hook has a certain rhythm about it that's really prominent as well, the drums need to kind of bang along with that as well and kind of really bring it out. And I definitely think one of the main functions of drums, sorry to cut you off there, is just between sections as well. A big thing that people, like, this is something to listen to in any production you listen to. One of the jobs of a drummer, or just drum production in general, is to signify there's a new section coming up here. Because if the drums sometimes one of the most repetitive parts, but right before the chorus in a rock song, you might have a fill, which means going around the drums, playing the different ones. It's the same with electronic production. Maybe you'll have a roll on the hi-hat right before you hit that crash, or, you know, it depends on the style, what exactly you're going to do. I definitely think in like a hip-hop song, to do a fill would be kind of cheesy, but just to bring something up, like just some extra snares. A riser is kind of part of the drums in many ways. That's the way I kind of think about it sometimes. Adding in an extra thing just to build it up. Between sections. And even if you need to come down after a chorus as well, the drums can help you do that. Because a lot of the time, that won't come across in your parts. Like, that's not the job of the keys, maybe. Maybe that's not the job of the guitar. You know, that could be a consistent thing. Verse and chorus, you know what I mean? So there needs to be something to prepare the listener that something is going to change. And like, I would say maybe 8 times out of 10 or more, the drums do that.
Yeah. And what I wanted to touch on there is what you were saying, like the drums is your rhythm section along with the bass. So if you've already written the bass, if you've already written keys, be aware of what the low frequency is already doing, because you want your drums to, you know, work with them, for them to work together to really, you know, hit home that rhythm and that vibe or the feel. Or if it's you're writing the drums first, then when you're going to your bass or your left hand and the piano later, make sure they match up so that they, you know, they're both adding to the same rhythm. Because sometimes you want differing rhythms, but I suppose there's always a balance to be found, right? You need to make sure our low frequencies are nice and together, giving the same rhythm.
Yeah, there's a few different ways of thinking about that. I mean, if, for example, the bass drum and the bass guitar are going to land at the same time, then you're nearly guaranteed that you're going to have to EQ them carefully, because they're going to be stepping on each other. One of the things that I do a lot in my mixing and production, even for some of the tracks we worked on recently, is whenever the kick is most important, like I would think about the kick drum pattern usually being simpler than the bass drum pattern. I think something that, you know, some styles do a bit too much is have the kick drum and bass guitar exactly lining up and kind of saying all the same things, if you will. You're guaranteed then that they're going to be fighting for space in a mix. So I would probably simplify the kick part a little bit, you know, and have the main emphasis of that rhythm. You add to it with the kick. And then from a mixing point of view, sometimes what I do is I sidechain the bass to the kick drum so that the bass guitar gets out of the way just when the kick drum hits, and then the kick drum is done so the bass can come back in. So I would definitely put the kick drum first in that sort of instance, because, and I can do that when it's a simple part, but if they're both playing like kind of a busy thing, then you're going to have to make them work together, and sometimes that is by sacrificing how good one of them sounds. You know, it's hard to say, again, it depends on a lot of things, but yeah, there's a lot to that. It's kind of one of the things that I spot in production as well, is how did the drums and the bass interact? One thing that, yeah, sometimes for them to match up too closely kind of annoys me a little bit, where like sometimes the high notes on the bass are actually played by the snare and the low notes will be played by the kick drum. And so they're playing the same parts essentially. I think that was really popularized by the Chili Peppers in like a rock context. And it's interesting sometimes when you hear that the two are kind of interacting in a different way and they're not just doubling what each other is doing. I think that's a really interesting thing and something to explore. And anytime I hear it now, it actually sticks out a little bit more. So yeah, something to think about. Like, are they lining up? How much? Is it every note? Is it some notes? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's funny, as you're saying that there, I was like, oh, I can instantly think of a few examples where the bass and the kick drum, say, don't line up together. Like even Bad Habits by Ed Sheeran, to pick a pop one. The subby bass, or it's like, yeah, it's like a sub bass thing. It's not really sub. It's just a bass synth is hitting on the syncopation. So it goes kick.
In between, yeah.
Yeah, so it's kick.
That's really common as well, yeah. And that just means from a technical point of view, like from a mix point of view, there's going to be more room for each then, because they're never crossing over, because they're both low frequency things, and that's notoriously the hardest part of a mix to get right. So, yeah, that's a common thing in dance music as well. You will hear everything sidechained off the kick drum. So if you want a bass line to come through, it's mainly going to have to be in the spaces in between those kick drums. So yeah, a lot of, like, if you just look up trance music, the bass line tends to be in the gaps between the snares or kicks, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to talk about some other rhythms, there's two rhythms that I find are everywhere in pop music at the minute. The soca beat, where the hits are on the and of two and on four. So it's exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3.
Gasolina.
There, gotta gasolina. Very good. And the other one as well is triplets. Triplet rhythm all over the place. Whether you're rapping like Kendrick Lamar or you're just playing.
Migos, that's their thing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Which is, I feel like those two are very common and sometimes used together. I actually realized the last day, the song Holiday by KSI. I don't know if you know. Are you sure you'd know? You'd know the YouTube scene. But that song has a combination of those two rhythms together in really light, kind of like, it's not very loud sounding drums that sound like real sounds that are just in there. One's pan slightly right, one's pan slightly left, further left. And it's just interesting to hear the triplet and the soca beat there somewhere. It's nearly always there. You can always find it in the pop in pop productions. So I think it's worthwhile, like, spending some time researching these sort of patterns that are always used and learning how to use them yourself. And even just seeing how they're, like, if you don't want to learn a lot of music theory, even get used to just seeing how it's written out on your, on say your what would you call it? The piano roll. Exactly. If you just see it on the piano roll, you can see it's on halfway through the beat of two, and on the beat of four, there's your soca beat. Triplets, it's three for every one beat. And the great thing is you can actually click on them and then quantize it into that rhythm, triplets at least. You can always select triplet rhythms. So that can help as well and getting to learn and where to use them. And then even if your hi-hats are going in a straight rhythm and then throwing a triplet here and there as like a little bit of a, you know, prettying it up in some areas or just giving some extra, ooh, interesting. Are there any other rhythms you'd find very common or you worth knowing apart from the soca beat or the triplet rhythm?
Yeah, none that really stand out like that necessarily. Just different, yeah, just different styles is more the way I think about it. And yeah, that you can't always put a name on them. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's if you're doing electronic music, that's kind of taken for granted sometimes as just the kick drum. It's already decided before the track starts that that's what's going to happen. If you want it to be a real kind of a dance floor type thing, or even just some of the kind of meditative music like Chiasmos, who I've mentioned probably 12 times already, and just John Hopkins, that sort of thing. There's a lot of that just repetitive kick drum, and then you build everything else around that. Just on the triplet thing as well, if you're looking for just a way to change up your rhythms as well, just start with a triplet grid and use it for the kick pattern as well. Get that kind of triplet feel in there as well. So some of those kicks that are in between the beats, you know, so to speak, or right before the snare drum, yeah, that could be a big thing. That's a big deal of thing as well. Or even we could start talking about, you know, quintuplets and that sort of thing as well. It's common enough. Like if you listen to Anderson Paak or that sort of thing, he'll play with that sort of feel about it, these kind of looser swings. That's something to look into as well. I was talking about it a bit earlier, but like actually looking at the swing that different tracks have as well. So the space in between having stuff spaced as triplets and having things spaced as eight notes or 16ths. So the kind of imprecise off the grid sort of things, you can put a number on that if it's actually a precise amount that they're late or early or off the grid, if that makes sense. So that's something that you can look into in your DAW as well. There's usually an option for quantizing to that. So I know in Ableton, there's over in the bottom left of the screen, there's a little section that says groove, and you can click in there and match the groove of some of the sample rhythms they have. So that's something I do a lot as well.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I've been messing around with having my hi-hats, the hat's always late, and trying maybe sometimes making the snares a bit early, and it gives that kind of weird drunk feel, kind of, it's just kind of weird, kind of, it's a nice off-settling thing.
Yeah, and like we were saying earlier, you can get experimental with it where every second hi-hat is late, do you know what I mean? Not just taking the whole hi-hat track and just shifting it over, shift every second one and see what that sounds like. Like I said, the classic thing sometimes is for, yeah, snares to be a little bit early and then any of the kind of offbeat kick drums to be a little bit late. But, you know, trying to find that sort of push and pull in music as well can be really interesting. So, yeah, something to explore. Like, I mean, there's so many things here to explore that, you know, I guarantee, like, if you're wondering how to produce kind of beats, we've probably covered one thing that you haven't done. So why not try that and see where it leads you as well? It's kind of a rabbit hole as well.
Yeah. And another thing, when you're layering samples or layering sounds, I think flam, that drum word, flam, is super important. Would you describe what flam is?
So flam is generally, in drums, it's when you hit with two hands almost at the same time, but not quite. So the really straightforward example is just the drumming of Dave Grohl. We were talking about this one day. If you listen to the start of Teen Spirit, when he's hitting the snare there, it's got an even bigger sort of effect than just hitting the snare with one hand. He's hitting it with two, slightly out of time. So just at the intro of Teen Spirit, I won't botch it over the mic now. But like that's a good example of flamming. And then you can work that into your production as well. One thing that happens a lot, if you're trying to make a really strong backbeat, sometimes you might want to layer a clap and a snare at the same time. But they can kind of get buried under each other sometimes, you know, if they're lining up and the transients or the attack of both of those sounds are lining exactly up, they might blend together. That could be good, but it could be interesting to push maybe the clap back is probably the more likely one, just a tiny bit, and see what kind of effect that gives. I mean, even the clap sound is based on humans doing that, where, you know, we all get into a room and, you know, we don't all have the same level of rhythm, or just, you know, human rhythm is kind of imprecise. So when people clap together, there's slight different delays, and that's what gives a clap that lovely vibey sort of sound. So yeah, you can do that in your own production by just nudging two things that were going to land together slightly out of time with each other, and seeing what the results are.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the coolest samples I have is from where we worked together, the Irish Institute of Music and Song up in Balbriggan in North Dublin. We had a class in, and I was showing them how they could remake Bad Guy in an hour. And I got them all to click, and naturally everyone clicks at slightly different times, and you get that really authentic, thick crunch of everyone clicking at just slightly different times. It sounds so cool. It really, just like Billy and Phineas did in the track, it's just so thick because there's so many samples and it has that flam effect. Just thickens it up, sounds really, really cool. And then for mixing together, I think we've touched on mixing really. Like, I think side chaining is a great shout for your kick drum. So low frequencies, be careful. You don't want too many layers. Anything about, we talked about this in the last podcast as well, panning them. Do you pan for the audience to where the drummer is sitting? So if you're at the, I prefer to pan for the audience. So if the audience is watching a drummer, they're going to hear the hi-hat slightly to their right ear. Would you do stuff like that, panning the drums in certain ways? Would your cymbals be wide, hi-hats?
Yeah, I definitely think, I think my approach to panning in general is the lower the sound, the more central it is. So I usually have the kick drum down the middle. Even though I play drums, I've never thought about, yeah, it's just not one of the things that I think about the hi-hat having to be off a little bit for it to sound real. Because I think if you're back from the drums, it doesn't really, I don't know if it translates exactly like that. So I'm not a big subscriber to that idea. But definitely the higher up you go, so up to hi-hats and shakers and that sort of thing, I think about panning. Sometimes I would do an auto pan, is what we might call it, or just, you know, a pan that moves back and forth, kind of a ping pong or something on some higher parts. That'll make it stick out. If everything is up the center, it can be very hard for it to, yeah, have its own space, really. So one of the easy ways to get everything to stand out is to pan things slightly differently. I'd be thinking if something is central to the track, no pun intended, like kick drum or snare, like just leave it in the middle for the most part. And then anything that's adding a bit of spice, so like your shaker loops, like we talked about, hi-hats, that sort of thing, yeah, think about panning them a little bit wider. It's a tough one. I'm just trying to think practically some of that stuff that I've done. I think EQ as well, like, it's something to really think about as well. And compression, actually, for that matter, especially with the higher parts. So sometimes with snares, for example, they can be quite dynamic. One of the things I would think about reaching for 90% of the time with a snare drum is a limiter to control the transient, because you want to bring it up in the mix, but at a certain point, it's too quick. It just happens. And I do mean the limiter, as in, because if you put a compressor a lot of the times on a snare drum, it won't act quickly enough to catch the initial attack of a snare drum. So a limiter would be a good idea to put on a snare drum sometimes. And it also sounds a bit more transparent, so it doesn't color the sound of a snare drum too much. Compression, I would usually think in a snare drum context, is for bringing out the sustain of a snare. I would use a compressor for that, by, you know, compressing and compensating and working with the release time. So I'd think about that. And then for parts like hi-hats, same thing again, limiting compression. Sometimes they can be a bit thin sounding. I would think about, yeah, the higher stuff, you could think about distortion as well, adding a bit of that, especially with hi-hats. Sometimes you want them to sound a little fuller and a little flatter dynamically. I really don't like if there's a kind of a hi-hat that's kind of poking you in the ear while you're listening to music. And sometimes if you've got like a really dynamic hi-hat and it's panned as well, it's just distracting you and making you think about your right ear a bit more than just the actual overall song. So that means you have to be really careful with the panning, how much, just a little bit is often enough, just a few percent. And yeah, then just looking at kind of taking some of that transient off, some of that attack off with a limiter, and then thinking about distortion to kind of taken out that sort of sound. And of EQ, of course. on the recent thing we worked on, just because there was so many synth parts and so many different guitar-y things going on that I didn't want to touch too much, and that I was kind of, my approach for a lot of that was to cut out the low end to make room for vocals, bass drums, that sort of thing, bass guitars. And then I was kind of pushing the high end on those. So I wanted to make sure that the drums, first of all, I thought they were kind of lo-fi sounding in general, or I wanted them to be that way, but also I didn't want them to fight with the synths and that sort of thing. So I was taking high end off of that. And my general tip on kind of EQing a lot of things, but especially drums as well, is when I say EQ, I'm usually like, especially at a production level, like if you're not a mix engineer, some people look at EQ as this like really precise thing where you come in and you take like kind of a bell curve out of it. Like, this is the area that's not good, so I'm going to turn it down. My approach, especially if you're a producer and you have a more general idea and you don't want to spend like 10 minutes just saying, like finding a particular frequency and taking it out and all that sort of extra thing, I would think about rebalancing sounds so that they work well together and using big EQ moves. So instead of on your EQ using a bell to just take stuff up or down, thinking about just a real simple EQ, for example, that just has bass, middle, treble, and pushing up the treble if it needs it, or taking out the bass or whatever it is, or just a shelf if it's on your kind of multi-purpose EQ. Looking at shelves and just bringing up whole areas. Really, with lots of things, that's another thing I see as well with some producers, that something will stick out in a not nice way because it's EQ'd so too precisely. Like, you can hear this kind of unnatural EQ on something, and really what you want to hear is just a sound that's well blended. So yeah, when you look at your drums and you think the hi-hat is a bit harsh, don't be looking to just pull out where the harsh stuff is. Just look at rebalancing it a bit and saying, like, I'm going to bring down the high end and bring out the mid-range, and now I've got a much nicer sounding hi-hat. So that's another mix tip there for drums. I got a few more if you have time.
Yeah, go for it, absolutely.
Just thinking as well for bass drums, one thing that a lot of electronic music producers do to make a bass drum stand out and not take up too much room at the same time is actually to just make a little dip in the mid-range for it, to separate the really low boomy part and the kind of clicky high part. My approach is that the clicky high part of a kick drum should be there, but you shouldn't hear it. You should feel it. That's what makes the kick drum translate, and that's what makes it sound loud on a mix, but also sound audible at all on a phone speaker, which is not something I think about a huge amount, but it's something I think about a little bit. And what I do sometimes is try and separate those two elements out a little bit, make a little hole in the middle, and that makes the low and the high end kind of contrast a bit more. So that's something to think about. And then the last thing that I would say, which is probably the number one drum production tip when it comes to like compression, because we already talked about limiting for snares, that's probably the number one. But the number two of getting things to sound a bit bigger is looking into parallel compression. This might be something you want to leave to your mix engineer, but essentially what parallel compression is using your normal drum sound and adding a super compressed version of that to your normal drum sound. So that means you keep the transients, or you keep the kind of attack of the different sounds intact. You don't squash them with a compressor. You add in an over compressed version to just bring up the quieter bits, and that makes them kind of sustain more, makes them a bit bigger. So that's something I think is a really important technique to look into as well. Once again, might be something that's more for the mix engineer to look at, but as far as if you want something to be really big and just sound massive, if you want your drums to sound really big, that's usually the way to go about doing it. It's to think about this parallel compression idea. So
yeah, absolutely. Oh, so much stuff there. So much good stuff.
We could do another one on just the mixing, the whole mixing ideas, but yeah.
You really could. But I wanted to stick majority of this to production, because I'm sure most people that are listening are sticking to the production, because the mixing thing, it's a whole...
I've bored them. They're tuned out now here.
Definitely not. It's a whole kettle of fish, and they keep on swimming around and trying to learn, catch a new one. That's so good. So good. Would you, just one last thing on the mixing part. Would you suggest trying to get all of those sounds in like one group? So you're, you know, you're mixing them all together as one unit, as opposed to a collection of different sounds.
Yeah, for sure. So when I was talking about the parallel compression there, that would be the whole drum bus or the whole drum group together. That's what I would usually think about doing in parallel. And that's another, it's a good point to bring up as well. The kind of different parts. So maybe you've got your kick drum, you've got your snare, and you've got your other stuff, shakers, hi-hats, cymbals. You want to, or, you know, and claps would usually go with snares as well. So those are groupings that you can think about. I would definitely, a lot of times when I'm mixing things, I'll do stuff to the individual tracks, sure. But if I am thinking about my track in terms of those groups there, I would probably apply a process. So either a EQ, compression, whatever my mix thing is, to them as a group. And that will make them feel like a group. So, for example, it's probably not advisable if you think, oh, the kind of cymbals or the high end of the drums here, it's a bit too harsh, and going instrument by instrument and absolutely carving holes in it with EQ and all these different things. It could be just a case of grouping them together and just rebalancing them with EQ as a whole for two reasons. One, you don't want to just overprocess things in general, like either at a certain point, either it sounds good or it doesn't. So you need to start from scratch, get some new samples, record the kit a bit better or whatever it is. That's the first thing. Another thing is you want to, want whatever you do to gel stuff together, as opposed to like everything just gets separated out and it can sound overproduced then or just badly produced. I'd be thinking about things as groups. So moving from like cymbals into the general drum group, and then there's the whole instrumental group doing something to, if I want them to sound like they're together, then I want them to share something. So maybe they share a reverb, they share an EQ, they share a compressor. These are ways of adding glue, which is something that mix engineers say a lot. You'll hear that.
Gotta glue it together.
Absolutely. And actually one thing.
Oh yeah, go for it.
One thing that I have to, it might be a good way to end, Hugh, because we've turned this up before, or we've talked about this before, I should say. The number one thing I hear actually from people who are starting out with producing that just sticks out to me is too much hi-hat and cymbals in general. We should have led with this at the front, actually, now that we're talking about drums, because I've said this a few times. We've had this conversation that you'll never hear anyone say needs more cymbals. I don't think that's a sentence that's ever been earnestly said by anyone. If you're thinking about the different important parts of your beat or your production in general, you know, we'll list things like the kick drum, the vocals, that if you ever hear anyone talk about the cymbals, it's going to be a very particular case. So in general, those are the type of thing we want to turn down. We can do stereo spreading and stuff like that, but yeah, that's something to be turned down in general, as opposed to it being equally as loud as those other elements.
Super. I was going to say, and I think that's glued this podcast together now.
You have to get that in there.
Yeah, I was going to glue this podcast together. How can people find you? Or you don't really like people finding you. You're off the grid.
But
if people want mixing.
Yeah, if people want mixing, I'm here to be found. Yeah, they can reach out to me by an email. I'm happy to work on whatever style or whatever project people are working on.
What email?
So it's just toshmalloy@gmail.com. So toshmalloy@gmail.com, and we can chat about music, and yeah, hopefully I can make your music sound better if you want me to do a mix.
Yeah, absolutely, and a good example to listen to your fantastic mixing and mastering ability is to check out the song we just finished recently. I was producing it for a friend of mine, for Puka, P-U, and then has like a fada, as we say in Irish. What would you call it? An accent. P-U accent, C-A, man of the hour, great tune, and you mix it so well. So thank you for that.
Thanks very much.
Super. Cool. Woo! Oh, I tell you, so much information.
That was a long one, I think, was it?
Yeah, it's an hour and, what, 5 minutes or so.
Oh, yikes. Okay. We'll see how many listeners you have by the end.
How was the audience retention? Oh, God. Thank you so much, Richard, for sharing your knowledge and expertise with us. It's always nice to have a doctor here spreading the knowledge.
Oh, stop. All right, well, thanks for having me on, man.
No, I'll tell you. Hopefully, you'll be on the next one as well. Continue the ball rolling.
Oh, my God. It's just, am I getting a share in this podcast? Or?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to just call it the 93 Acres and Dr. Richard Molloy podcast. I think this is the only option.
Rolls off the tongue.
This is it. Yeah, you'll give you a 50% cut or 49% cut, just in case.
Cool, super. Man.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too.
Cheers. Bye.